Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now. Driving. At your desk. Maybe at the gym. But you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach. And see a rocket launch. Or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Well, as predicted by me on this show, Australia ran away with the first test in dominant fashion. Don't check the tape. Welcome back to Cricket Unfiltered. I'm Andrew Mensel. I'm joined by Paul Dennett. Paul, we should be watching the test right now, but it's already done.
What a game. I mean, it was looking like Australia were facing a bit of an uphill battle. I remember you and me at the end of day one, where Australia were 3 for 98 in reply to Sri Lanka's 212. We were both thinking it was an even money bet. And what was it? Straight away on day two, Travis Head got out pretty quickly. And then it was just, it was looking as though it was going to be one of these familiar situations in the subcontinent. And then I just thought that Cameron Green was marvellous. I don't think Sri Lanka bowled especially. I think their field settings to him were poor. They were allowing him to take too many singles. And he said, yeah, sure, I'll take them all day long. And he and Carey and, of course, Khawaja. And then Cummins hitting a bit at the end got Australia up to 321. And I think then Sri Lanka, as we kind of foreshadowed last show, they kind of fell victim to their own you know, they're hoisted by their own petard, to use a cliche, that because the pitch was spinning so much, you know, Travis Head started to look like an off-spinning version of Shane Warne. And once it gets, the pitch gets, when Travis Head is bowling unplayable balls, then anything can happen. And yeah, it was a really good win in the end.
I mean, we'll get into more details, but the day three was bizarre. It started the day with Australia batting, and by lunch, Australia had won the test by 10 wickets. Sorry, they were batting in their first innings, and by lunch, they'd won the test by 10 wickets. I mean, I felt like I was tripping or something. Like every time you looked away, there was another Sri Lankan wicket. I'd go up to make a cup of tea, I'd come back, and then they'd have lost two more wickets.
Well, I was working, and I had the cricket. I was in a media blackout. As soon as I finished work, I was going to watch it. And then you sent a message, and I saw it was from you, but I didn't want to read it because I thought it might contain the score. So I got my daughter. So I said to her, can you just check that there's nothing urgent in that message? And she said, no, all he's saying is, do you want to record a podcast tonight? And I thought, wait a minute. This is interesting. And then I couldn't resist looking at the score. I couldn't believe that the game was already all over.
Incredible. Well, look, let's go back to the beginning of the test match. There was a lot of speculation about the Australian team selection. I guess would Head or Maxwell play? And in the end, they went for Head. What did you think of the batting order?
I made the point on Twitter that I had no problems with Head playing because I like him. And I just think that they had to find a way to get Maxwell in the side. You know, they'll say we won, who cares? The results justify that. But I just think that Maxwell deserved a spot in the side. And I still think we went in with one fast bowler, at least one fast bowler too many. And I think that you look at the next test, who do you think is going to be more effective? Let's just say Mitchell Starc or Glenn Maxwell in the side. I'd much rather Glenn Maxwell in the side than Mitchell Starc. And I think that that's no slight on Mitchell Starc. It's just that if that first test was spinning sharply, and I presume they're going to use it's not going to be the same pitch, obviously, but it's going to be a very similar pitch in the same venue, then do we really want to go in with two fast bowlers plus Cameron Green, who didn't even get a bowl? You know, collectively for the match, Starc and Cummins bowled 21 overs. So I think that there is, you know, there is a case for saying we need to get rid of one of the fast bowlers.
Well, yeah, Cummins didn't even bowl in the second inning. So, yeah, it was Rana. So Rana Paveen was very unhappy. He tweeted me almost like I should sack you from the show. He says, sorry, Omanas, love the show, but cannot agree with Paul's comment about dropping Cummins. Averaged like 22 in Pakistan and in conditions where every other bowler averaged more than 30 except Nazim Shah, who missed a test. So I guess if that – you go on.
Well, I was going to say, I wasn't saying so much as to drop Cummins, but that they should be willing to consider dropping him and not picking him solely because he was the captain. And I think that, I mean, Cummins, as I've said in other shows, is on his way to potentially becoming the best fast bowler Australia has had maybe ever. That's how good his record is. So, yeah, I absolutely agree. His record is absolutely superb. And he bowled really well in the few overs that he bowled. A few of those balls in those first overs that he bowled, I thought, if this pitch had anything in it for the quicks, they would have been getting edges and he would have been taking wickets. And, you know, for the match, what did he bowl? 12 overs, 1 for 25. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. So it's pretty much his stock standard performance, which is fantastic. He batted quite well as well. So I was more just making the point that they've got to be willing to be flexible and that the captaincy shouldn't hold this enormous thou must not drop ever situation. But, yeah, I mean, I think that, again, also the fact that Cameron Green didn't get a bowl is reasonably significant because I think he'd be fairly handy on that, but there's just no cause for him to bowl.
I think it's bad news for Maxwell because I actually don't think he'll play in this series now. I think the Australians will go in with the same team. I just think it's the Australian way. Don't change a winning team. Travis Head took those wickets. Green scored the runs. You got Cummins, the skipper. Starc can bowl with the you know, we reverse swing if it gets that far. So I actually think, unfortunately, we won't see Maxwell at all in this series.
Yeah, and again, I'm sure you're right. And I just think it's sort of muddled thinking that you're better, rather than looking at the existing side and saying, who can we change? You should pick the best 11. And then, you know, however the cards fall, they fall. And Maxwell's in our best 11, especially in Sri Lankan conditions.
Mm. And then moving sort of forward to the Australian spin bowling makeup, there was some discussion that John Holland might pip Mitchell Swepson for the spot. But then Holland had an injury cloud, and I think they went with the incumbent Mitchell Swepson, who I thought bowled well. What did you think of Swepson over the others?
Yeah, I mean, I probably wouldn't have picked him, but there's not a lot to choose from. Like Holland hasn't been all that impressive at test level and with the injury. Kuhneman's very inexperienced. I do like a left arm orthodox spinner in Sri Lankan conditions. Having said that, I thought that there's Emble Denia, who'd been so good against England when England were last there. I think that was the difference in the matches. If you imagine last time around Australia were facing Herath, Emble Denia bowled terribly. He was pitching the ball too full, looked impotent on that pitch that anyone could take wickets on. I think they need to make a change there. But, yeah, I mean, Swepson bowled well. He picked up wickets. He can't do much more than that. And fair enough, too, because he had in Pakistan, the conditions were very, very difficult for anyone to get wickets. So you deserve some swings and roundabouts and to get a nice pitch to take some wickets on.
Yeah, I think it would have been unfortunate for Swepson to have been, you know, taken around the world as part of the touring squad for a few years, playing Pakistan, as you say, in very unfriendly conditions. And then you get to a ragging Turner and they say, it's all right, mate, we're going to rest you. I mean, he's probably thinking, well, if you're not going to play me here, you're never going to play me.
It would have been unfortunate, but again, that's not the way to pick the sides. It's a big business. Who cares if it's unfortunate? If he's not good enough, don't pick him. You've got to be more like Sir Alex Ferguson, Menes.
Well, this is where I think we're going to get into an argument, because I think that we're seeing with the George Bailey era, and a little bit under Justin Langer, but more under Bailey, that they are sort of treating incumbency with more respect. And you and I know when we grew up, the Australian test side, once you're in there, if you were performing, you know, that it was really hard to get you out. They didn't just drop you on a whim unless you're Dean Jones. But now it seems like Bailey's going back to that. If you've earned your spot, unless you fuck it up, then they're not going to chuck you out. And well, I don't mind.
It was a mistake.
Well, I disagree.
It was proven wrong back in the day. The reason that we were so successful back in the day was not because we kept Mark Taylor 25 test matches after he should have been dropped, and didn't pick Matthew Hayden for years, and didn't pick Adam Gilchrist for years, and never gave Michael Bevan a proper run at test level. And all the mistakes we made because of the ridiculous respect for incumbency, it's because we had a generationally brilliant group of cricketers. And so it would have been very unfortunate for Mitchell Swepson to not make the test match. And I'm happy that he did. And I'm happy that he did well. But that's not the way you pick the side. Pick the best 11. It's not a kindergarten.
But I think that there is something to, fostering a good environment in the dressing room, making players feel confident so they can go out there and play their natural game, play a bit of bazball, play some reverse sweeps. And so I actually think respecting incumbency and giving players a bit of confidence that they can, they'll hold their spot if they perform is actually not a bad thing. I mean, I sort of think, okay, it would have been good to get Maxwell in, but Head's done really well for Australia in the last 6 months. Green's a performer, a great all-rounder. So, yeah, I sort of think that's good for the team.
But you can have both. I absolutely agree that you want to foster a great culture in the dressing room, and performances do need to be respected. But the way you respect performances is you pick the best 11. And occasionally that might mean that someone misses out in a slightly harsh way, but that's the way it's got to be. And you can explain it to them in a proper way, in a way that's not going to destabilize the dressing room mood. And I just think if you were picking a test side for the next match and your life depended on it, I think you'd find a way to bring Maxwell into the side, because his bowling will be very effective on those wickets and his batting will be very effective. I think he offers more than Stark would offer, for example, in the next test match. And I think it's strange as well that spinners are so kind of discriminated against, because if you had a test match at the Wacker and it was followed by another test match at the Wacker, and in that first test, Australia picked two spinners, and sure enough, it was a trampoline, bouncing, fast bowler's paradise, and the spinners didn't really do much, you would just naturally drop them both for the next test. You wouldn't give it a second thought. Yet, because we sort of feel like you must have fast bowlers, that we would never even contemplate doing that. All I'm saying is that it wouldn't be the craziest argument to say that you should omit both Stark and Cummins from the next test match. Have Green if you need any CM up bowling. But the reality might be, why is that funny?
Because I was just starting to come around to maybe dropping one of Stark or Cummins, and now you've gone the next card. Drop them both.
No, well, it drops the wrong word. It would be to say, if the second test pitch looks like it's going to be the same. They put the stats up. Gall has the second best record of any pitch on earth for spinners. And so, as I said, comparisons to the Wacker are apt. You would never pick two spinners in the Wacker, and I'm talking about the Wacker of the 1980s in its heyday. You wouldn't pick one. Why should you pick two quicks when you've already got a third one, Green, who could do a decent job? I just think if we're going to have the same thing in the second test match where Cummins and Stark between them bowl, 23 overs between them in the match and take two wickets, when Travis Head is bowling unplayable balls, that you'd be far better off bringing in Maxwell and bringing in another batter. And look, they're not going to do it, and maybe it's a bit too far, but at least drop one of them. I'd remove Stark and bring in Maxwell, and I think the side would be better for that.
Yeah. I would do the same. I would drop Stark for the next match and bring in Maxwell. I think that's an astute selection. But again, I mean, you've won me over on your argument. You're basically picking Cummins now because he's the skipper. Because if you're actually picking a more balanced team, you would pick Stark and you got Green as the right arm opening bowler, and Cummins sits out and Captain Grumpy Steve Smith gets another shot.
Well, part of the reason I'd pick Cummins is you batted well.
It's true.
He's batting. Who are we going to pick? Inglis or someone? I think maybe Cummins's overall package might offer more. And can I just say, for those of you who think that the idea of dropping a fast bowler to bring in a batter in these circumstances is crazy, and if Stark takes 5 wickets in the next Test match and wins the match for Australia, which I hope he does, I don't want to have to want him to fail when I watch that match. So please address all correspondence to Menas if that happens.
Yeah, no, we just want to be right all the time. We don't care about the Australian team.
We want to be right and have excuses if we're wrong.
Yeah, but going back to my original point, I think Australia will just pick the same side. Now,
undoubtedly.
Exactly. After a 15-minute discussion about it. Sri Lanka won the toss, elected to bat. They went for just one fast bowler, Asitha Fernando. Then they had Embledania van der Say and Ramesh Mendes as the three bowlers. So no real surprises with the bowling attack. A fine counter-attacking innings by Dick Weller, the wicketkeeper, who made 58 off 59 after Sri Lanka was 97 for 5. The leading wicket taker, so they roll out for 212 on the first day. Stark took 1 for 31, Cummins 1 for 25, Swepson 3 for 55, including 2 in 2 balls. They were jaffers. They were terrific leg spinners to get those 2 in 2.
That was a great moment. And the catch that Warner took, juggling it to get the second one to get him onto a hat-trick, yeah, it was really electrifying stuff.
Yeah, great stuff. And then Nathan Lyon, 5 for 90, his 20th 5-wicket haul. He finished the match with 9 for 121 and is now 10th on the all-time leading wicket takers. I thought he actually bowled superbly right throughout this match, even though the Sri Lankan batters took him on.
Yeah, I think he bowled well. And all credit to him after the final Test match in Pakistan, where he won us the game as well, to take 9 wickets in this match. Is excellent. I mean, we've kind of gone down the rabbit hole of selection, and I want to stress as well, this was a great win by the Aussies. Like, really, looking at some of the recent performances, that 2016 tour where Australia lost all three tosses and lost all three matches on, you know, violently spinning pitches. And I liked Cummins's press conference or his presentation afterwards, where he made mention of how proactive and how brave the Australian batters had been. And I think that's a really good point, that you look at some of the strike rates of the players who in the Australian innings, that Green going along at a strike rate of 71, Carey going along at a strike rate of 96, those two substantial contributions, Khawaja at the top of the order. I mean, right at this moment, he's the best batsman in Australia, isn't he?
Yes, and I heard the radio commentary making a point that he's one of the, like, his average opening the batting for Australia is as good as any opener to ever play for Australia.
Australia overall average. I mean, it would be nudging 48 now. Like, he's gone from an overall average of around the 40 mark to suddenly knocking on the door of 50, which has always been the test of greatness. So it's been an incredible rise since his return just a few months ago.
That's right. So Khawaja and Warner got Australia off to a rapid start. They put on 47 inside 10 overs. Warner was out for 25. Then Labuschagne was out for 13, reverse sweeping straight to a fielder. Probably not the best shot, but that was their game plan.
Yeah, you got to score though, yeah.
It was just, I think, usually you reverse sweep to open up both sides of the field, but there was a fielder there, so it's...
True.
And then Steve Smith, so controversial moment. Steve Smith gets run out for 6. It looked like Khawaja barbecued him and ran him out. This was still on the first day. We haven't even got to the second day yet. And Smith was remonstrating. He was visibly upset. He looked, you know, seemed to be looking across at Khawaja a lot. I said a few things. I guess, firstly, on the run out, whose fault do you think it was?
I found it hard to judge because on the first live viewing, I thought it might have been more Smith's fault than Khawaja's. But, and I actually, it was around about the time when I was watching it on delay and it was about 2 a.m. and I was starting to fall asleep and I didn't actually see the, did they go into it in great forensic detail on the replays? Did they show a reverse angle to see the calls that Khawaja made? I'm not sure. I think it was just a mix-up and I think that maybe, I thought that maybe Smith was every bit as much to blame as Khawaja. What did you think?
Well, my analysis seems to, and I sort of listened to some of the commentators who might have had access to the stump mic. So I think the way it was, you know, Smith played the shot. The ball sort of goes out into the offside. He sort of motions to run it, but puts his hand up. And then Khawaja goes, yes. And then it was too late. And Khawaja sent Smith back then. And Smith was run out. So I actually just think it was bad running. Like, I think if Smith had made a loud, decisive call and it was his call because the ball was in front of square on the offside, then this doesn't happen. So I probably think it was maybe like 52% Khawaja's fault and 48% Smith's. Like, because Khawaja probably should have not called yes. But so, yeah, I'm leaning slightly Khawaja.
I think what happens in those as well, that it's just one player communicates yes or no to the other player, and then there becomes this kind of pongoing effect where once it gets out of control, it never gets back in control. And I was saying to you and Jaleesa in the group chat, I wonder why they never try to do anything about that. Mix-ups are just accepted as, oh, well, occasionally they happen and it's a result of bad running. Yeah, it's bad running, but it's almost inevitable once there's that breakdown in communication and you've only got a split second in order to fix it. I reckon they should put in a thing like, if we have a practice, the moment that there is hesitation or some form of confusion, both players are trained to just ignore the run and return to their crease. Just turn their back on each other, go back into their crease and say, we'll squander the run, and try to eliminate as many mix-ups as possible. What do you reckon?
I don't mind that idea. And I do think Australia had in their head, they've got to be aggressive. They've got to turn the strike over, because I think, say, Australia's batting on the last day of a match to save a game, probably don't even consider running there. But because they're playing, you know, this new style of cricket and being brave, they're looking for every single. So they were sort of being ultra aggressive. And yeah, it didn't work.
Yeah, I think that's good. But I think that if they have that as a backup, saying, let's be ultra aggressive, get as many runs as we can. But every now and again, if we have to squander a run because, oh, I thought, well, no, I'm going back. At the end of a series, look back and say, well, we had no mix-ups and we might have cost ourselves 7 or 8 questionable singles. It's a good trade-off, I think.
Yeah, and usually when someone's run out, it's that hesitation that's the difference. So you're right to say you should just go back, because once you've hesitated, that's when someone gets run out, you know. So it's not a bad call, Mr. Dennett.
Thank you. Now, you weren't all that happy with the way that Smith carried on, were you?
No, not at all. I thought it was pretty piss poor, actually. And it reminded me of when he was in Sri Lanka last time as captain and he was blowing up at first slip every time something would go wrong. And look, he's the vice captain. He's a senior figure in the side. He has every right to be upset when he gets in the dressing room, if he needs to blow off a bit of steam or maybe chat to Usman after the play. But he should know better that on the field. And he did it during the season when he there were some comments made about his performance for Australia in a one-day game at the SCG where he shook his head as he was going off. I just think he's got to do better, Paul. And this is probably vindicated the board's decision not to give him back the captaincy.
Yeah, I think you've won me round. I wasn't so bothered by it initially. And I'm never as bothered when players are reacting honestly to something that's a little bit of a flare-up. I like that much more than kind of, endless sledging. So I'm sure 5 minutes after he did it, he regretted it. And I'm sure after play, he would have said something to Khawaja. But I agree with you. He should have been able to handle it better. And it was an example of why he didn't make, part of the reason why he didn't make a great captain. It's quite interesting watching England and India in the first day last night. there was Potts got a nick and it was spilled by Crawley, a tough catch it in the slips. And Stokes ran up with the biggest grin on his face and sort of hugged Potts as if to say, that's it, mate, keep it in that area and you'll get wickets. And, I mean, England just seemed to be the happiest dressing room I've ever seen. But it was quite telling that I don't think ever as captain, whether Smith would have been reacting the way that Stokes did at that point.
I wonder which senior member of the Australian side was tasked with going up to Smith and having a word with him about that behaviour. You know, would Pat Cummins have taken the responsibility and maybe later that night asked Smith if they could go for a coffee or the next day or whatever, because, or was it Andrew McDonald? But, you know, I'd love to be a fly in the back room to see, you know, how that played out, because someone in that side would have had to counsel him about that behaviour.
Someone could have taken his side and said, mate, we really want to get Maxwell into the side for the next test. We're not sure who to drop. And we're thinking maybe we should drop Cameron Green. But the thing we like about him is that he never gets angry and carries on like a psychopath when it gets run out. So have you got anyone idea who we should drop?
So very disappointing from Smith. I think the century drought is starting to get to him. I think he knows he's the best player of spin in the top six. I think he felt the pressure there.
He did look good for his 11 balls.
He did, didn't he?
He was a very good six.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we both predicted he wasn't going to have a great series and we both hoped we were wrong. Pretty unfortunate to get run out. So let's hope he gets some runs in the second test.
Yeah, so then you're right. Early the second day, Head gets out, just punting a ball back to Dananjay De Silva, the part-timer. So I thought Head didn't look great with the bat. I know it was only 16 balls, but he didn't look to have a stronger method as some of the other Australian players.
It's tough as well that he's going to struggle in the second innings of matches, not that he had to bat this time, but all our left-handers, I think, are going to struggle in second innings where there's potentially some foot marks as well. But, yeah, you're right. Didn't look all that good. And you can certainly say my clamouring for Maxwell certainly didn't drop at that point.
So Green comes out and plays a brilliant inning, 77 off 109 balls, six boundaries. What I loved about Green's innings was he used his big stride. So he was driving the spinners, but when that wasn't there to drive, he was lunging forward and sweeping. And sometimes I had my heart in my mouth because I thought he was going to miss it and get plum LBW, but he'd get a bit of bat on it. But I thought it reminded me a bit of Kevin Peterson, just the way he'd used a big stride to play the spinners, and probably the best test innings I've seen him play.
It would have been good to have Ian Chappell commentating it, because he would have gone berserk, I reckon, at the Sri Lankan methods, that they were just content to allow him to take the singles easily, as though singles didn't count. And Ciappelli always says, as a fielding captain, your number one priority is obviously to take wickets, but closely followed, number two, is to stop singles. Number three priority, a long way below, is to stop boundaries. And they had it the wrong way out there. That inside-out field, they needed to bring in two or three and say to him, if you want to go over the top, go for it. But he was just playing with great pragmatism. Of all the players, again, Cummins talked about it in the post-match press conference, his first sort of innings in these kinds of conditions, and players over the years have really struggled to get 77, was fantastic. And it was good that they gave him the Player of the Match award.
Yeah. I was surprised Lyon didn't get it. I thought Alex Carey, for me, played the innings of the match. He comes in with Australia, what were they, 5 for 157, so it's still, you know, still 60-odd behind. And he just scored at a runner ball, 45 off 47. He didn't let the spinners settle. He was sweeping, reverse sweeping. It was just a Gilchrist-like counterattack. And then when he gets out, Australia's in the lead, 6 for 241, and the game's totally turned around.
Yep, and that's a mark of the smart play that the Australians have over there. That in the past, a player in that situation, obviously not Gilchrist, but other players would have felt the pressure of, well, we've really got to value our wicket here and grind it out. But a good 45 at a runner ball over there is worth 100.
Yep. And then there's some nice little contributions. Cummins 26, 3 sixes to end day two, Lyon 15 not out. It was quite bizarre at the end of the second day. Cummins hit this massive six out of the ground and then they went off for bad light.
Malcolm Conn wrote a good article about it and saying, you know, how's that bad light when he's hit one of the biggest sixes anyone's ever seen? And that this is at a time where Cricket Australia is potentially in danger of losing its broadcast deal. We always talk about Test cricket struggling. They've got to do better. And the other, you've got to protect the safety of the players. And it'd be a bad look if there was a massive swipe from Cummins and it smashed someone in the head at midwicket because they didn't see it. But I've said it many times before. Rather than going off, just switch to the pink ball and on you go. It would be far better.
So Australia all out for 321, a lead of 109. I wasn't impressed with the Sri Lankan spinners. Ambul Denia, 15 overs, none for 73. Mendes, 32 overs, 4 for 112. Van der Say, 10 overs, 2 for 68. I don't think they responded at all well to the pressure that the Australian batters put on them. And, yeah, actually, you know, I think Australia's spinners outbowled Sri Lankan spinners comfortably.
Yeah, and I don't know why they – I mean, they'd be better off getting I've forgotten his name. They're good off. They're good off spinner from the T20. The number one in the world.
Hatteras. Don't want to get his name wrong.
I've had a mental break. But maybe they'd be better off getting him in the side because Ambul Denia has to be dropped. He looked just woeful, and the Australians were just milking him, and that was bizarre. So I thought Mendes looked all right. That he was definitely the pick of them.
And then Sri Lanka comes out before lunch on the third day. And, they had suffered a big blow. I mean, no one's talking about this, but they lost Angelo Matthews 10 minutes before play on the third. 10 minutes before play on the third day due to a positive COVID test. So, Oshada Fernando came in at the last minute. So that's a big blow, losing one of your best players. And then they were just rock and rolled for 113 in 22.5 overs. The wicket takers, Lyon 4 for 31, Swepson 2 for 34, Head 4 for 10, hadn't taken a test wicket, ends with 4 for 10. Australia just needed 5 to win. They ended up 10 for none. Warner 10 not out. Australia won the game inside 154 overs. Just extraordinary.
Yep. Hasaranga. Winindu Hasaranga is the guy's name.
That's it.
Maybe they'd be better off making some changes in the next test. But I heard the stat after the innings. It was the shortest innings that Sri Lanka's ever played in test cricket history in terms of number of overs faced their second innings. So pretty disappointing from the Sri Lankans. I know we've been praising the Australians for being brave and bold, and the pitch was starting to spin a lot, but I think that they'd be pretty disappointed with the way that they batted in the second innings, I think.
Oh, it was shocking. It was awful. I mean, some of the stroke play was just diabolical, but it seemed like no one could pull their head in even for a few overs, and they just kept. I almost thought they'd get like they just given up. Like once they lost Matthews and once they lost a few wickets, they were just like, "Well, we'll go down blazing," and it just never worked. And it's a, I felt that if they could get maybe 150 in front, they had a real chance at putting some pressure on Australia with the ball ragging.
Absolutely. So, I mean, look at day three, the morning of day three, and Travis Head is unplayable. What would that pitch have been like after, on day four? I mean, it was never going to get to day five, but wow, that's would have been interesting to watch it on day five, that pitch.
It was a great catch. Was it David Warner? No, who was it in the second innings, maybe offline? Anyway, some good fielding, good performances by the Australians. They would have had a great all afternoon to celebrate. Man, the player of the match was Cameron Green. The game was, 30 wickets fell in 6 sessions.
It was Labuschagne. Labuschagne took the
catch.
That's
it, yeah.
Dequela and Labuschagne dived and took it, and they had to check whether it caught it. Yeah, it was a really good catch.
So just a dominant performance from the Aussies. They go 1-0 up in the series. I thought everyone performed well. Lyon now the 10th leading wicket taker in history. I sort of reflect on Lyon's career, and you know, the last few tours of Asia, he's really done well. And you know, he did well in Pakistan, and then he did pretty well when Australia was in India in 2017. So look, he's become the all-round package.
Yeah, it's incredible. 10th most wickets of all time. That's some stat. It was in Sri Lanka that he got his first wicket with his first ball, wasn't it?
At goal. So he's now level with Dale Steyn on 439 test wickets. He has 25 wicket hauls. Only four other Australians have done that.
Who would you rather face an over of, Dale Steyn or Nathan Lyon? Just joking.
Yeah, well, I think we know who the better bowler is. I mean, I was looking at Dale Steyn's record recently because he was on a podcast, and I was just looking at his – I mean, he's just the most incredible destructive bowler, Dale Steyn. I don't think I appreciated maybe just how good he was. He missed the last tour to Australia with an injury, which was a shame, but he's incredible. Oh, breaking news, Paul. Just an update from the Sri Lankan tour. Ashton Agar has been ruled out of the second test.
That's disappointing. I forgot John Holland's about him.
Yep, so he won't be able to play.
But he would be the – I would definitely have picked him if he was fit.
All right, so we'll
just on Steyn, the one thing about him is that we talk about that strike rate of – I've just looked it up now. Took his wickets at a strike rate of 42.3, and actually Rabada's up there as well, 40.7. But they are kind of – whenever you look at great bowlers – anyone who's doing really well, you know they're doing well because everyone who surrounds them is from the dim, distant past, because back in the 1800s, the pitches were so much more difficult. But, yeah, he's right up there. You know, that's a wicket every seven overs. Pretty special.
Absolutely. Well, that's it. The second test starts on Friday. So there's actually a big gap now because the test finished so early. Got almost a week between the first and the second test. We talked about this, what Australia might do. Sri Lanka have to do something, and they'll be really hoping Angelo Matthews recovers from COVID and is fit and available.
Yeah. I think that they do need to make some changes to their spin bowling department as well. And same as with us. I know that Fernando got a couple of wickets and there's a bit of reverse swing for him, and he got rid of Cummins and Swepson at the end of the Australian innings. But I still, I'm not even sure if they need him in the side.
All right. A couple of bits of news before we wrap this up. I wanted to touch on this last time Paul and I recorded, but I forgot about it.
Because we were switching topics. I just wanted to say one other thing. That moment that Travis Head got Dananjaya DaSilva Plum and Kumar Dharmasena, who's normally a pretty good umpire, but he didn't have the greatest of matches, he gave that not out. So for anyone out there who still doesn't like DRS, get someone who knows how streaming works to show that, get the match up and search, see if you can show you how to watch it. And if you wouldn't own a laptop yourself, but see if you can watch it and just see that. Imagine if there'd been no DRS, the rancor that would have occurred, how angry the Aussies would have been, and all, you know, the lovely sort of vibe that this series is being played in would have vanished. So another win for DRS. I just wanted to make that point.
I mean, I was looking at that going, if he's not going to give that out, what is he going to give out? Shoulders, arms in front of middle stump, back. I mean, it was the most plum LBW. It was just unimaginable that he wouldn't give it. He would give it not out. And I heard someone criticising the umpires because you think they've got a bit lazy with DRS. And looking at that one, I'd have to agree.
No, they've got better with DRS because in the old days they could just give not out and the commentators, it was probably missing leg. And you look at the replays now and realise it was plum. I just think he had a shocker. And people would say, that was just an umpiring mistake. But, yeah, they make mistakes. Guess who also made a mistake? The batter. It was a pretty ordinary shot as well.
That's it. All right. So, yeah, the IPL broadcast deal, some stunning figures and a stunning deal. It will change the landscape of cricket in the world. Do you have any, like, figures, Paul?
I do. I've converted everything to Australian dollars. It was a bit confusing because you never know whether they're talking about in American dollars or rupees. So everything Australian dollars. So as far as just the television rights only, Star India, who were the previous owners, have won the deal again. They're paying $4.4 billion Australian dollars over the next 5 years. And then, interestingly, the Viacom 18 have got the digital streaming rights for the next 5 years for slightly more. They're paying $4.5 billion for the next 5 years of that. So I think it's rather significant. There are many things about this that are significant, but one of them is that already the digital rights are worth slightly more than the television rights, which is an indicator of the way that the world is going. But it's the best part of $9 billion Australian for the next 5 years across TV rights and streaming. That's $21.5 million per game. Now you can see, why the BCCI tried to play through COVID. I know that that's more than the existing rights, but that is a significant amount of money. There's also a third domestic package, which I think is still yet to be sold, where they're going to offer non-exclusive rights to stream 18 of the most sort of high-profile matches, so they'll make a little bit more money than that. But just to give you an example of just how much growth that is. And I'll switch to Indian rupees briefly, that in the last TV deal, the Star bought the entire digital rights and television rights for 163.5 billion rupees. This time round, they've paid 235 billion rupees, so 70 billion rupees more, and they've only got the TV rights. So that's just an incredible amount of money. And the final comparison, as I said, it works out at $21.5 million Australian per game. That's the second highest sports league in the world per game figure. The only one bigger is the NFL, which recently signed an Australian $166 billion deal for the next 11 years. That's a sixth of $1 trillion for the next 11 years. When you work it all out, theirs comes down to $52.5 million a game. So it's $52.5 million a game. Second place is the IPL, $21.5 million per game.
I think third place is the English Premier League. Mm. But they are extraordinary figures. I think there will be far-reaching consequences to this deal, especially in Australian cricket. So already there seems to be a bigger window about to happen for the IPL. So, you know, it's sort of 6 to 8 weeks at the moment. That's going to be pushed to 10 weeks soon, that there'll be an IPL window where you'll see basically no international cricket for 10 weeks. So that's going to happen. And then, and that could be stretched out more. Maybe the IPL want 2.5 months soon, and then they'll ask for 3 months. So, and then who knows where it could go.
Yep. And I think that this has crossed a threshold as well, that up till now, it's been the players who've been from the sort of less financially, the less affluent nations who've been really prime for the picking for the IPL, that you look at players from South Africa or the West Indies, where an IPL deal is life-changing and massive compared to their annual salaries that they would get from their own cricket boards. Up till now, that hasn't quite been the case in places like Australia. It's still huge money for 2 or 3 months, but it's been roughly sort of in the same ballpark as what they'd be earning for their national side as well. If this flows through eventually, as I'm sure it will at some point in the not-too-distant future, to player wages, then the $3 million or whatever it was reported that Pat Cummins was getting, if that bumps up to $6 million or $7 million, and if regular players start to be getting $2 or $3 million, then, you know, the luster of the Australian contract starts to diminish. And, I think it's great on the one hand for cricket, but on the other hand, as a lover of Test cricket, you just hope that India keep the love for Test cricket going and don't allow this deal to start to destroy it.
Do you think there's a chance that cricket could end up being a bit like international football, where national sides are really fighting with clubs to be allowed to use a player? I mean, if an international cricketer is getting paid, as you say, $6-7 million to play in the IPL for a season, they might say, look, maybe we don't want you playing a lot of international cricket. We want you coming here fresh.
Oh, it's a very good point. And also allied with your point about the potential increase in the length of the season. At the moment, it still feels like it's just, oh, it's a brief little window where it's on. But if they start to push that out to 3.5 months or 4 months, it soon starts to get not too different to, you know, like a season of NFL, which isn't actually all that long, but it starts to become more than just a boutique little window. It's it's the bread and butter of the sport. And who knows what the... who knows what the outcome will be. It's funny, I was thinking about it, how in 2007 there were all the 30-year documentaries about World Series cricket and Channel 9 sort of talking about the revolution and everything else. And you look back now and it's kind of like, it'd be like people attending a 25th anniversary of the start of World War One in 1939 saying, well, that was the war to end all wars. You know, the revolution is over. Everything's changed. And suddenly a much, much, much bigger revolution is about to occur. Well, the Second World War wasn't a revolution, but you know what I mean. So, yeah, I just think that it would be – I'm willing for the IPL to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And – if it means that Test cricket has to change a little bit and that there are fewer series involving some of the nations that don't kind of generate as much money, that's okay. As long as there's enough of it still at the premium level, and if things like the IPL can kind of help prop it up, that's better. Because for me, as much as the IPL is entertaining and I really do enjoy watching it, it's not the same as international cricket. I find the same thing with soccer. Like I like soccer a lot. And if I'm watching sort of Manchester United versus, Manchester United are no longer probably the ones that you'd pick, but if I was watching Manchester City versus Chelsea, the fact that all the players are not from the Manchester City area or the Chelsea area, and it's just kind of people from all over the world who've been brought in, it does diminish it a little bit for me. And there's something that international sport has a level of significance that club sport doesn't have, and maybe club sport did have when they all came from the local area. So when it's kind of Mumbai Indians, everyone's coming from all around the world to play for them, and it is a product and it is a sort of manufactured and everything else, I have no problem with any of that, but I find it hard to feel like it matters as much as a test match between Australia and India seems to me still to have some sort of bigger significance than just the entertainment factor.
I wholeheartedly agree with you about the significance of test matches, and I think we will see some aspects of international cricket whittled down to just the big series that, as you say, the ones that generate money. I mean, I've got 2 points. A, that there'll be a player drain now because it'll be so lucrative to play on the T20 circuit. I think there'll be a lot of players who go down the avenue of not being too fussed whether they play for their country, especially the cricketers that aren't, say, classically, say, a test batter or a bowler, that are, you say you're Tim Davis, you're big hitting all-rounders, just made for T20 cricket. I think they'll just try their luck. They'll throw themselves out there into T20 leagues around the world. And we've seen that the way to do it, if you go to, say, a Big Bash or a CPL and perform, then the IPL goes, all right, well, we'll give you a contract. You've proven your chops. So I think we'll see a player drain, and especially from the smaller countries.
I'm sure it's already that way. I'm sure that if you interviewed 13-year-old kids about their future and asked them for their dreams, that their dreams would be very, very different to the cricketers of 30 years ago who would have all, oh, I want to play for my country, I want to play test cricket. I'm sure all of them now would be saying, I want to play in the IPL and make an absolute fortune. Mm-hmm. And it's fun. Like, I mean, the notion of having to grind out 100 over 7 hours against fast bowling and get 15 different bruises and exhaust yourself versus, oh, I'll just go out there and bang, 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 I've hit 4 sixes and I've scored 30 off 15 and that's the job done. It's a lot easier and it's a lot more fun. So I'm sure that's the way that people are starting to think. I wouldn't mind if the whittling down of international cricket was to whittle down some of the meaningless 50-over matches. I think that's hopefully what this will cause, a reduction in bilateral 50-over series rather than a meaningful reduction in test series.
Well, this kind of then leads into my other big fear, that the fact that the Indian cricket is generating so much money for their domestic competition, will there be the same impetus from the Indian national side to tour overseas and play? I mean, they're a great team. They're always in action, playing series all over the place. Now, will the revenue be, you know, now that the money's all coming from the IPL, will we see less of the Indian team playing international cricket?
It's a good point. I think there's always that risk that while Kohli was captain and he loved test cricket, there was a feeling of that was going to be respected. And I think that they want to respect it, but all it would take now as well would be a dispute. And if India suddenly feel like they've, you know, we've seen examples of it. We saw it when India were out here with the Queensland border restrictions and the quarantine and whatever else, and they weren't happy about it. There'd be always the temptation now for them to just say, well, guys, we can always go and we are absolutely fine because we've got an absolutely incredibly lucrative competition that we can just play in and we can extend it for 9 months if we want to. So there's always that kind of, they hold the power. And there's nothing wrong with that because of course they hold the power. They're 1.4 billion people in a cricket-loving country that dwarfs everywhere else in the world. So I'm absolutely fine with that. I just hope that their administrators keep on realizing that it's also in their own interests for test cricket to still prosper. I mean, Gideon Haig's line was T20 cricket needs something to be shorter than. That if it's just T20, I don't know, it starts to lose a bit. You might say, well, there's T10 that it can be, T20 cricket can be in place of. But yeah, who knows what the future holds.
So I guess to sum up my feelings, Paul, I'm happy that so much money is coming into cricket. The fact that, you know, the second richest competition in the world is now a cricket competition. As a lover of the game, I'm happy about that. I'm happy that if you're an aspiring cricketer growing up in the world now, you know, there's so many ways to make money and make a living. You're not just relying on your national board to pick you, and you know there's just more opportunities for cricketers now. There's more opportunities for coaches. I mean, we could keep going, but it's also, you know, the IPL drains a lot of the best coaches from around the world as well. So there are implications, but I guess I am just worried about, you know, when we're recording Cricket Unfiltered in 2030, what the game will be like.
Mm. Our friend Patrick Avenel always said that eventually the Ashes will be a five-match T20 series between Mumbai Indians and Chennai Super Kings. So hopefully that hasn't happened by 2030.
And then the final bit of news I want to touch on is the staying with broadcasting, Channel 7, who, for those overseas listeners, have the rights to test cricket, and a majority of the BBL are taking Cricket Australia to court, and they're alleging that Cricket Australia has not delivered an appropriate standard of the Big Bash, and looking, I guess, to get out of their contract, and maybe they want some money back. Very concerning, Paul, to have this sort of breakdown between, you know, the free-to-air broadcaster and Cricket Australia.
Yeah, I'm not as concerned about it as I was when I first heard about it. I think that also in the reporting they've talked about that when the next TV deal comes up, that Channel 7 may well still bid for it. So it's more like, it's not as though cricket itself has become uncommercially viable. I just think that they're not happy with this current deal. And so that ring fences the concern a little bit for me. You know, I'm happy for them to biff it out and hammer it out in the courts if they feel that way. But the fact that also in the longer term, they'd still be willing to bid for it again shows that it still is a lucrative sport to broadcast, and who knows what the future holds, because I think in 10 years, it'll all be digital, it'll all be streaming, and maybe the concept of free-to-air television will be vastly different to what we know today. But at the moment in Australia, it's still the king, that if you don't want to offend too many free-to-air networks, because we've only got three big ones, and Cricket Australia were very harsh in their treatment of Channel 10. Channel 9 were kind of happy to see the back of them. Channel 7 are now taking them to court. So on the face of it, geez, the last thing we would need is some, Amazon or Apple or someone to scoop in and get the rights to cricket going forward, because at the moment that would be a disaster, because there are still plenty of people who just switch on the TV as if it was 1985. But that era is dying, and, you know, who knows what the longer term holds.
Well, it seems to be Channel 7's main complaint is around the Big Bash. And apparently in the contract that Cricket Australia promised to deliver a certain quality of competition, you know, an international world-class competition. And then if you believe some of the reporting from, say, Ben Horn, who's been on this podcast many times, listeners will remember him, he's a chief cricket writer for News Corp. He's detailing that Channel 7 are not happy with the standard of players, especially last season and under the COVID situation where there were sort of teachers and stuff playing. And then also in the stuff prepared by Channel 7 for court, you know, they were also very unhappy that Steve Smith wasn't allowed to play in the Big Bash last year. And if that's not the biggest own goal or stuff up from Cricket Australia of last year, I don't know what is, but it seems to be around the Big Bash. As you say, Test cricket is still very lucrative and the ratings have gone up, but the Big Bash is suffering. And Channel 7 also seemed to have documentation from Cricket Australia that they were concerned about the Big Bash as well.
Yeah, that Steve Smith thing. Needed Kerry Packer. Kerry Packer alive. You just rung up the head of Cricket Australia. Smith's playing. And that's, you know, that would have been the end of it. Cricket Australia, yeah, they stuffed up on that. But I think it's true that last summer the Big Bash did fall off a cliff. And the ratings bore that out, that even in the previous summer when things hadn't been quite as good, the decline from the peak wasn't that significant as far as TV ratings were concerned. And then last summer everyone lost interest because there were, as you say, teachers and whatever part-timers playing. But I think that was just COVID. It was extraordinary circumstances. And the Smith debacle aside, I think Cricket Australia scrambled reasonably well to put a decent showing up. I think next season, this coming season, is going to be key. If they can get the Australian players playing and the draft goes up successfully, then I think it will be a much closer to what it, you know, to back towards its peak. And hopefully the next TV deal, it is Channel 10 that they've talked about getting it again. I'd love it if it just all went back to free to air. Channel 10 showed it every night. Then that was what worked. I think it would work again.
Yeah, I think Channel 7 have a little bit of a case about the Big Bash last year, like you say. So, yeah, look, let's see how it goes. All right, let's just end this recording. I've got a Can't Let It Go from a listener that I wanted to run by you, Paul. This is from Ronnie Mack on Twitter. He sent us a message. G'day, boys. I've got a Can't Let It Go. Now, I think he was watching the Sri Lanka tour at this stage, and he writes, batting figures, 75 for one. 75 for two as he was typing. So the batting is 75 for two, so 75 runs for two wickets, but the bowling figures are 2 for 25. Any reason for this? That's his Can't Let It Go. Now, as a stats man, Paul, should there be a standard?
Well, in Australia there is. It's always it's 2 for 75. It's the rest of the world that does it the other way. And I think the rest of the world does it that way because they sort of say, you know, you have scored 176 runs for the loss of four wickets versus you have taken five wickets at the cost of 37 runs. And people from England I've heard espouse that argument as though it makes all the sense and that theirs is the only way of doing it. And I just say, obviously, ours is the right way of doing it because in the same way that Americans, when they're defending not using metric system, they say, you know, the imperial system is what got humans to the moon. And I'd say our system is what won us 550 over World Cups.
How many World Cups have they won?
The rest of the world's won, what, seven or something like that. So, yeah, you know, clearly you could draw a direct line between saying 2 for 75 and test and one-day success and more recently even T20 success.
So there you go, Ronnie. I knew Paul would have an answer for you. America, cricket in America is going through the roof. They're building stadiums. They've got the World Cup there with the West Indies in a few years. Cricket in America is on the up, Paul. We might have to relocate to the land of stars and stripes.
Yeah, it's on the up. I'm not sure if it's going through the roof, but it's certainly on the up from a low base. But you know, the Indian diaspora there is significant, so there's every reason it could continue to grow. One other thing I forgot to mention during the IPL discussion was, although it is true that it's the second most lucrative in a per game sense, it's not quite an apples with apples comparison. I'm sure that if the IPL instantly went to the length of the Premier League, they would lose they'd obviously get more money in total, but the per game figures would drop because it's just harder to keep that level of interest for 9 months. So it's slightly comparing apples with oranges, but it's still an extraordinary figure.
I mean, I was just looking at it, say, per ball. So if it's 21 million Aussie per ball and they play – oh, and you remember, not all games get all the ball. Yeah, so $21 million per match. Divide that by 240 balls, and not all the games get them all in. It's $87,500 per ball as Aussie.
That's pretty impressive. Yes.
A lot of money. All righty. Well, Troy replied to a tweet when I said we were going to do the show. He said, I thought you were going on holiday again. Well, Troy, it is actually happening now. So Paul and I have had a very serious podcast meeting in the last week, put our heads together. And so we're taking a month off now. We'll be back in early August. But then we have made the commitment. We'll go back to our regular weekly show from August. So, yes, there you go, listeners. We're coming back. Jaleesa will come back sometimes. We'll get guests on.
Yeah, it's going to be great. We keep on saying we're about to take a break, and then we keep on doing a podcast that this maybe in the next couple of days it'll be announced that they're going to go to a five ball over or something, and we'll need to do a podcast on that.
An emergency podcast, exactly. Yeah. Well, everybody, thanks for listening. Paul, great to catch up, and we'll be back soon.
See you, everyone.
On Florida's Space Coast, we think you can have the best of both worlds. Kind of like right now, driving at your desk, maybe at the gym. But you're also grooving to some music. Visit us and you'll go to the beach and see a rocket launch or go kayaking and manatee spotting. It's all waiting for you on the only beach that doubles as a launch pad. Plan your adventure today at visitspacecoast.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.